Hey, folks, you're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. But there's a bigger version, and dare I say, better version, that awaits you over at ROFpodcast.com. Head over there, sign up for the full podcast. It's available only to our members. And by becoming a member, you support this program. It's really our main source of revenue. In fact, it's virtually our only one. Radio as a business has dried up, but it's important for us to get the message out on radio. That's the only way we're going to reach people, folks, beyond our own little silos. So get more of Ring of Fire every week. Get access to our archives and help us get the message out by becoming a member. Go to ROFpodcast.com now. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, John Nichols from The Nation magazine will join us to discuss the rise of a strong progressive electoral wave that's sweeping the country. Washington Monthly's Martin Longman will be here to discuss the Freedom Caucus and their effect on healthcare legislation moving forward. And attorney Peter Mouget will be in studio to give us an update on the opioid epidemic and why reports of fewer prescriptions don't tell even a bit of the story. Lastly, Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to help me recap the biggest stories of the week. Become a Ring of Fire Radio member today. Go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. There are two ways you can help. You can sign up for the free one-hour version of the podcast and get an hour of the show delivered straight to your computer or device. Or you can get the full program by becoming a member. Pay month to month or sign up for a full year and receive a greater discount. That's ROFpodcast.com to help support keeping this program on the air. Joining me now to help recap this week's biggest stories, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Digby, Donald Trump was at the G20 this past week, and they have not officially referred to it as the G19, but there was definitely a sense that the pictures we saw of Donald Trump sort of wandering around as if he was, I don't know, somebody's husband, brought to the Christmas office party. And didn't know anybody there, and no one really was terribly interested. That those pictures and those images, I think, make for a fairly decent metaphor for what's happening on the world scene.
Well, it's true. I mean, I don't know that we expected him to be, considered a genuine, authentic world leader by this particular group. I mean, other than one expects that the United States, regardless of who's president, will be, seen that way, being we're the world's biggest military power. But he really went above and beyond in sort of demonstrating that he was not interested at all in playing the kind of role that American presidents have always traditionally played, which was the leader of this group, and there are 20 world leaders there, as the central, leader, the central character in this big world drama where the United States is at the center of world affairs. And he just basically, I don't know that he didn't want to be that. I think he wants to be the center of attention. He just doesn't understand that role. He just doesn't get it. And in fact, of course, we were all very excited to see how he was going to behave with Vladimir Putin. And he inadvertently, and I'm not sure he understands it even now, sort of granted that role to Putin, the one that he would normally have. He, by saying he was honored and focusing so much on that and failing to even try to interact with any authority or any kind of leadership with the rest of the leaders there. He was basically, it appeared, if you were just looking at the pictures, and you know, old Karl Rove always used to say that politics is TV with the sound turned off. If you were just to look at the footage, you would think that Putin, that Vladimir Putin, President Putin, was that leader, the one that the United States traditionally sort of held in those situations. And Trump basically gave that to him gladly. And I'm not sure he understood that he was doing that, but he did it. And it was slightly disconcerting to see that happen.
And we should make the point, like, that interaction is... is metaphorical. I mean, at the end of the day, right, those things may have some relevance, but only because they fit into a broader narrative. And, you know, if you're the rest of the world and you saw the colossal screw up that was Iraq, and you thought, what's going on here with America? 10 years later, the country elects Donald Trump president, and they're all getting a better sense of this guy every time they meet him, and they can't believe it. This reflects on the country, and it's and we see it in the context of the G20, who have all signed on to the Paris Accords, and they have said, we're not going to renegotiate. If the U.S. wants out, the U.S. is out. And you start to see these world leaders, they have jobs to do. And the idea that they would begin to peg their long-term economic, their long-term national security, their long-term energy policies, their long-term immigration policy, all of these things, they would peg not the watershed of the basically democratic nations over the past 70 years, but to autocratic powers like Russia, like China, because there's a vacuum there with the United States. And it's not just because of Donald Trump. It's Donald Trump is a reflection, theoretically. You know, for you and I, we can sit here and go like, oh, well, maybe if somebody gets hit by a bus or, you know, if we get super lucky, things will get reversed and we'll right the ship and everything will go back to normal in some case. I mean, we can hope that, whether we think it or not, but from outside of the country, it just looks like this is a society that is having massive long-term problems and is reflected by who they've chosen as their leader. And I just can't help but think, and this is, you know, as a longtime more than skeptic of American exceptionalism and one who thinks that America has a lot of work to do to be the force in the world that it perceives itself. I just think the whole world looking to two autocratic societies, different in different ways, but autocratic nevertheless, for leadership is a bad thing for the world, for the future of the world.
It absolutely is. I mean, you and I agree. We've been harsh critics of many of American policies, and I think that there is definitely has been a case to be made that America's role in the world as the only military superpower was probably not something that was sustainable or desirable for us to continue, and that there needed to, you know, after the end of the Cold War, we needed to be evolving into some new arrangements that sort of would be the guarantor of global security. But never in a million years did I think it would be preferable to have these autocratic societies taking on that role.
Right.
That is not a good idea. I mean, just because America may have run its course in this particular role does not mean that it just should default to something like Vladimir Putin's Russia or the Chinese capitalist slash authoritarian system that they have. That is not a good idea. And what we're watching is, and I think you're absolutely right, I hadn't really thought of it that way, but when you put together those two, you know, the bookends of Iraq and then the election of Donald Trump, and, you know, in between there was Barack Obama, which kind of raised hopes, I think, that the Iraq debacle and the election, you know, it was a dubious election for Bush, too. You know, he didn't really win a majority. And
yeah.
he was, you know, he kind of slid in. And that was kind of a sign that maybe our democracy was a little ill. And then Barack Obama came along, and it was a big, he won a big mandate. And it, you know, he was a step forward. And, you know, we had our critiques of him, but he was a genuinely democratically elected leader with intelligence and integrity. And, you know, he was not somebody that you just kind of quiver with shame whenever you saw him on the world stage. I mean, he was someone that you Americans could feel proud was representing the country. And then to just have it just be completely crumbled, that 8 years that Obama spent doing that. I mean, in fact, the polling is showing that around
yep.
the world, the you know, Obama had like a 64% median approval rating, and Trump has 22%.
Yep.
The only two countries that see him in a positive light are Russia and
and
Israel.
And the problem is not just that it's Trump. The problem is this is their perspective on this country. And
yeah.
to a large extent, it's you can't blame them. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll touch on this a little bit more, but we also have to address the fact that Fredo Jr., Donald Trump's son, apparently was looking for Oppo in all the wrong places. We'll be right back after this.
I know the score.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon.com. So, Digby, before the break, we were talking about the implications of Donald Trump at the G20. And, you know, it's one thing for Donald Trump to be hated. It's another for the rest of the world to say, hey, you know what? To the extent that the United States was diminishing in its power and authority, Donald Trump just hit the accelerator and drove off the cliff. And I would just add, as just one little button for that, because I want to talk about Donald Trump apparently looking for opposition research from just about anybody who would give it, and one particular direction in particular. The big fear I have is that what we're losing with the world is our soft power.
Yes.
Because our military is not going away. And as we find we lose our relationships and our ability to influence things in the world and to be a beacon from all the things that are good about America, all that's left is the military stuff. So make no mistake about this. This is not a recipe for us to become a less militaristic country. This is a recipe for us to become, and my concern is, a more militaristic country.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. I honestly don't. And I think that one of the big problems here is that our soft power, and I don't think people realize this, it has always been the soft power that was creating the security umbrella. I mean, sure, we are the greatest, strongest military on the planet, but we proved over and over again from Vietnam onwards that, you know, as far as wars were concerned, we weren't particularly effective. So it was the soft power that was truly what the United States was offering the world. And if all we have left is the military power, I'm afraid, as you say, it's going to be unleashed in ways that we don't want to see that happen. We don't want that.
I am really concerned about this.
Yep.
And because, you know, all of a sudden everybody turns their backs on, you know, the bully. The bully's going to want some attention, and I'm very concerned about that particular dynamic. But
yeah, I agree.
Let's turn to another story that was pretty huge. You don't have to be a Russia alarmist or conspiracy theorist or any of this. You don't have to even look for any sources outside of Donald Trump Jr. himself to find this story shocking, to say the least. Apparently, according to Donald Trump Jr., I mean, there was a story that was released in the Post, but he came out with a statement in that story that more than confirms what I think is really disturbing, that Donald Trump Jr. was enticed into a meeting with a Russian attorney with, according to his statement, connections to the Russian government on the promise of basically some type of important oppo research against Hillary Clinton. He said that he invited Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort, didn't tell him why they were coming. Just one of the old, I know it's in the middle of a major campaign, but come to this meeting for no reason whatsoever. And they came, apparently, according to Trump, it was a false alarm. They had no good oppo research on Hillary Clinton. Imagine if we found out that in the lead up to the 2012 election, Barack Obama's son or daughter or close confidant met with Iran for damaging material on Mitt Romney. I mean, the impeachment hearings would already be, you know, would be over in, you know, the first 6 months of his second term. I mean, this is an incredible story, even if we take Donald Trump Jr.'s word on it.
Oh, absolutely. I think we have to take his word on it. I mean, he sort of guilelessly just went and, you know, spilled the beans and said that, you know, yeah, I was asked. And here's the thing that I find amazing. It was revealed that the person who, you know, turned him on to this source of information was a music publicist. So imagine he goes to Paul Manafort and says, hey, this music publicist friend of mine has some, you know, some dirt on Clinton. Come on, Kush, you know, come on, come to the meeting. I mean, that would never happen. Of course he mentioned that it was Russians. Of course he knew. And if the minute that happened, Paul Manafort knew that he was treading on very, very dangerous ground. There's no doubt in my mind. Maybe Kush, I don't know. Maybe he seems to know a lot of Russians and kind of have a strong desire to hang out with Russian bankers and what have you. But Manafort, that man knew exactly what was going on, and he did it anyway. I mean, there have been GOP campaign operatives coming out of the woodwork saying we would never do that. Many of them saying I'd call the FBI the minute I heard about it because this is not done. And yet they did it, all three of those guys, and you will never, ever persuade me that they didn't know that they were meeting with a Russian lawyer who was Googleable, you know, and was definitely involved, closely associated with the Russian government, closely associated with money laundering mobsters in New York who were under indictment by the New York, U.S.
Attorney General. Yep.
I mean, it is a big story, and, you know, we'll see how it plays out. I do love the fact that they're going on TV now and saying, yeah, it's no big deal. Yeah, collusion, whatever. Not illegal.
All right, Digby, we got to take a break. Please join me in the next hour. We can talk a little more about this. I don't think this story is over. We got to take a quick break. Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. When we come back, Nation Magazine's John Nichols is going to talk to us about a new progressive electoral wave that's sweeping the country, and you probably haven't heard about it.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. While the media has focused more on Trump's Twitter feed, an underreported phenomenon is taking place. Progressive candidates are winning elections across the country, including districts that Trump won in 2016. Here to explain what's causing this phenomenon and to tell us about it is John Nichols from The Nation magazine. So, John, and you wrote your piece in The Nation magazine, a progressive electoral wave is sweeping the country, before earlier in this week, I guess it was Tuesday, when there were a couple of House races, Oklahoma House races, that Democrats won. In last November, Karen Gladys lost her race by 20 points. On Tuesday night, she won that same district in a special election by 4. In a second district, Democrats had won just 42% of the vote in November, but pulled in over 50% last night, winning it fairly easily. And these were two districts that Hillary Clinton did not perform very well in 2016. And like I say, you had a piece out earlier in the week that a progressive, maybe last week, a progressive electoral wave is sweeping the country. How so?
Well, this is the point I've been trying to make, and I think it speaks to issues you and I have talked about many times. We have a media in this country that, by and large, cannot see beyond Washington, D.C. It does not reflect or even acknowledge things that are happening across the country. So when it covers elections, special elections, off-year elections, our national media will pay attention to special elections for congressional seats, because that is a reflection of Washington. As it happens, the recent cycles of special elections for congressional seats have all been for very safe Republican seats that the national Republicans are very interested in holding. They pour a lot of money into them. They do a lot of strategy in them. And as a result, you should expect Republican wins there. Doesn't mean that you should be happy about it, but that's relatively predictable. Where you get a better measure is if you step out of the Washington bubble and you look across the country in the absolutely critical races for state legislative seats, which ultimately define in our two gerrymandered system the district lines for not just legislatures but for Congress, for city council seats, for mayoralties, for school board seats across this country, what we are seeing at that, you know, one rung down from the Washington level, is a striking number of unexpected and notable victories for progressives who are taking seats that were historically Republican and who are winning in places where Donald Trump actually did very, very well. And what I'm arguing is that if we're to have a realistic sense of kind of where our politics is and where it might be going, and also for to get a sense of what might work in this evolving politics, we've got to look beyond the Washington bubble down to places like Oklahoma and New York and New Hampshire, all places where traditionally Republican seats, in one case up in New Hampshire, a seat that for hundreds of years has been Republican, have this year flipped to the Democrats. We should also be looking at places like St. Louis and Cincinnati and other spots across this country where progressives have won or done very, very well in critical primaries and elections with messages that are much bolder than most of what we're hearing from Democrats in Washington.
All right, let's break this down a little bit more and then build it back up to figure out what's going on. But broadly speaking, and we should say, it's not a coincidence that those special elections for Congress were in heavily Republican districts, because they happened because the Trump administration has appointed someone, one of those congresspeople, to a position. And one of their calculations is, how safe is this seat? Can we afford to lose this person when we have such a narrow majority in the House? Democrats do the same thing, though, you know, maybe not with, you know, well, I think probably with the same sort of calculations, hopefully. But when we look at special elections, broadly speaking, how important are they in terms of determining trends? How much of an indicator are they in any time? Put aside for a moment the era we're living in.
Sure. I think that's an exceptionally good question. I've covered special elections for a very, very long time. And I can tell you that both parties get very excited about individual elections. You saw a bit of the frenzy with John Ossoff race down in Georgia, where really the whole of the country, and in fact, the whole world, was paying attention to this one race. And they were imagining that this would tell us everything about where our politics is. The truth of the matter is that we've had special elections in Democratic cycles. There are Democratic presidencies that have gone against the Democrats, and the Democrats have come around to retain the presidency and maybe even retain the Congress. And we've had the reverse. And so we have to be careful about overreading anything. Now, where you begin to get useful information is if you look at a pattern of special elections, and if you look at a pattern of normally scheduled elections, and you say, okay, are there things happening that are significantly out of the norm? Are we seeing, you know, legislative seats in Oklahoma, an incredibly red, incredibly Republican state, flip to the Democrats? Are we seeing historically Republican seats in New Hampshire, out on Long Island, flip to the Democrats? Are we seeing progressives win city council, school board, mayoral races where they haven't won in the past? Are we seeing in a statewide race in Wisconsin, where the superintendent of public instruction ran for reelection as a critic of Betsy DeVos, as a critic of school choice and experiments that are damaging to public education, as an absolute defender of public education and a friend of teacher unions? Are we seeing a person such as that, who was targeted for defeat by the same interests that have been associated with Betsy DeVos and Donald Trump, are we seeing that person win with 70% of the vote, a strikingly powerful landslide victory? Well, all those things have happened in the last few months. And what I would suggest to you is this. We don't have the absolute proof from special elections or off-year elections at this point that there really is a pivot that has occurred in America. But what we do have is proof of something that is significant. And that is that in places where Donald Trump won in 2016, Democrats have been winning in 2017. So all of this fantasy that somehow this whole politics has shifted in a way that, you know, can't be gotten back, or that Democrats don't know how to win. In fact, they do know how to win. But then when we dig deeper into it, what we find is that very often when they are winning, it's not by running to the center. It's not by running very cautious campaigns. It's often by running very blunt campaigns that combine a resistance message, a resistance to Trump, with a vision for the future that is actually very progressive.
I'm glad that you got there, because what I want to do, John, is I want to take a break. And when I come back, and when we come back, I should say, I want to ask you what it is we're seeing. Are we seeing anti-Trumpism, or are we seeing a surge of progressivism, if you want to call it that? Are we seeing an ascendant left? Has one short-circuited the other? I mean, that to me, as, you know, two people who have been looking to push our politics to the left for as long as certainly I've known you and you've known me, and you've been doing it for a long, long time. Are we seeing that as opposed to just a repulsion at Donald Trump? That's the question I'm going to pose to you when we return. We got to take a quick break. I'm talking to the great John Nichols from The Nation magazine. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Boom, 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 boom. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with the Nation's Magazine's John Nichols about his piece, A Progressive Electoral Wave is Sweeping the Country. So, John, when we broke, we were talking about a wave of elections across the country, which at the very least, a trend is there that Democrats are doing much better in places that they had not done so well in as recently as 8 months ago during the 2016 election. And in many of those races, Democrats have won. They haven't been the congressional seats. But of course, in all those congressional seats, they actually did much better than they had 7 or 8 months later. But, you know, this is not, we're not playing horseshoes or grenades, I guess. And you got to get a win. But we're seeing wins in key state house races, in mayor races, in statewide races across the country. And so my question to you is, why are these people winning? Are they winning because the left is just so, and by the left, I'm very speaking broadly, the anti-Trumpers are just so appalled by Donald Trump that they're more motivated and they're going out and voting in special elections when people who are more or less content with things, they're not as motivated to go and vote on an, not just an off-year election, but like an off-off-year election? Or are we seeing an ascendant left ideology that is driving this?
I think that's a terrific question, and I think the answer to it is a little more complicated than you or I might like. And here's the bottom line. There are folks who are terrified by Donald Trump's presidency, so horrified by it that they would, you know, crawl through snow, you know, on the coldest day of the year to cast a ballot, right? They're going to be the first at the polls, and they're ready to object and to try and, in their best and most effective ways, to send messages. There's no doubt of that. And we should not deny or diminish that. That is a part of the politics of off-year elections. It's a part of the politics of special elections. Some of those sentiments actually benefited the Republicans 7, 8 years ago when they had people who were so Tea Party folks and such who were so viscerally anti-Obama that they would come out for an election for drainage commissioner and vote against a Democrat because they thought they were sending some kind of message to Obama. So both parties have some of that. But what I wrote about and what I'm continue to be quite fascinated by is these circumstances where people who are, of course, opposed to Donald Trump, but who are also passionate about putting ideas on the table, and particularly people who are looking at new economic models, new approaches to jobs issues, how well some of these folks have done. And I think this is a very, very big deal. If you look at the new mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, Chakwe Lumumba, this is a fascinating guy. He's a young fella in his 30s, a civil rights, human rights lawyer, the son of a former mayor. But he proudly acknowledges and proudly identifies as a radical. He says, I am about radical change, and I'm about radical economic change. And the things that he proposes are all sorts of cooperative initiatives, local democracy that really mirrors models we've actually seen in some other countries where you get citizens involved in the budgeting from the grassroots up, all sorts of really creative stuff. And this guy swept to the mayoralty. He was defeated in a mayoral race a few years back. This spring and you know, into June, both in his initial race and in his runoff race, huge victory. And I have to believe that a part of what's going on is that there are folks, be they Democrats or independent lefties, wherever the context, some of these races are nonpartisan, who are scoping out what is necessary. And that is an alternative to Donald Trump's incredibly simplistic, often wrong-headed responses to economic insecurity and tension. And this is a big deal. And I think you, Sam, above all other folks, would understand this, that if you look at the pattern of victories across the country, where these people are winning, they are again and again winning by saying, yes, we're opposed to Donald Trump. We don't like what Donald Trump is doing. But more importantly, we have a real alternative to Donald Trump. We are not just simply saying no to this guy. We're saying we have better ideas. And in the Tony Evers race in Wisconsin, that statewide race for superintendent of public instruction, I was powerfully struck by the willingness of Tony Evers in a state that Donald Trump narrowly won, in a state where the Republicans clearly have seemed to be very ascendant, to say bluntly, I don't agree with Trump's selection of Betsy DeVos to be Secretary of Education. I don't agree with the agendas of the Trump administration. And I've got an alternative vision that puts new resources into public education, that emphasizes making our rural schools secure and making new commitments to our urban schools. That was, you know, he had an agenda. And so I would argue that these victories are driven as much by an agenda, and frankly, a very progressive agenda, as they are by simplistic anti-Trump sentiment.
And so I guess the answer is it's a little bit of both. I mean, this seems to me,
there's both there.
This seems to me to be the challenge, right? Is to not alienate those voters who are entering in because they are anti-Trump, but at the same time also being able to push a candidacy that goes a bit further than these voters had contemplated in the past. I mean, you know, the thing is, like, we don't have a real clear notion of exactly who those anti-Trump voters are and why they're showing up in that way. And we don't know, are people being, you know, are we driving turnout? Is turnout being driven, I should say? I don't want to take credit for this. I want to give it where it's due.
Not you personally.
But is turnout being driven because of organizations that have cropped up that are fighting Trump, some of which are, like, you know, the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, have sort of exploded in growth. Working Families parties, or also Indivisible, which is, you know, certainly obviously to the left of Donald Trump, but maybe more people who hadn't been associated with politics before or aren't really about an ideology. I mean, it's a question of, like, harnessing this, and we're going to get pushback, it seems to me, from the moderates, so-called moderates and centrists in the Democratic Party. We just have a minute left, but, you know, how can people sort of fight that almost two-front battle?
I think that the way to fight it is to go out and talk to the folks on the ground. And what you find is that many of the distinctions that the people in Washington, both at the higher levels of politics, higher levels of media, tend to make, and they try to imagine that there's a Hillary Clinton wing versus a Bernie Sanders wing, that there, you know, are moderates versus liberals, that there's these real deep divisions. They see that, or they imagine that, at the national level. I got to tell you, Sam, I've been all over this country. When I go into communities in Iowa and Wisconsin and Michigan and Arizona and other places, I don't hear that. What I hear is people are deeply concerned about their country, and they're looking for answers. And so when you present answers, yes, you present answers that you explain well and that are appealing. But I think that there's a great openness to progressive solutions and a great frustration with kind of empty centrist solutions. And I'll give you one final thing, Sam. I hear this everywhere. People want reform that makes democracy more fundamentally, more functional. They're furious about gerrymandering. They're furious about money in politics. They're furious about the dysfunction of our politics. And so I think many of the candidates I'm seeing do well really are reformers who run against, if you will, the compromises of both political parties.
John Nichols from The Nation magazine, thanks so much for your time. Always, always a great honor.
Pleasure. Good to be with you, Sam.
John Nichols is The Nation's national affairs correspondent. He's the co-author with Robert McChesney of People Get Ready: A Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will be back to help me talk about some of the big stories from this past week. And if you're listening to this show on the radio and you miss any part of Ring of Fire Radio, you can sign up for our podcast at rofpodcast.com. It's a great way to support the show and to make sure you never miss a moment of Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, and you're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.